Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carletta Goal, who has worked for The New York Times since 1999, including more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Pakistan. She previously worked in the Balkans and in Russia, where she reported for the Financial Times and the Moscow Times. Since 2001, she has spent longer than any other Western reporter in Afghanistan, living among the Afghans and traveling extensively through the region. She was the lead reporter on the New York Times team that won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2009 and is now the Times' North Africa correspondent. Her latest book just out is The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan 2001 to 2014. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carletta Goal.
Thank you.
And your book has a number of explosive revelations in it that indicate Pakistan, a country that has received close to $30 billion in taxpayer money since 2001, has in effect been America's real enemy in Afghanistan. And how much would you hold them responsible then, by extension, Carletta Goal, for the 1,000 NATO troops who have been killed, as well as the 2,300 American soldiers who have died in America's longest war?
I think they're very deeply culpable, because what they did over the years, and I watched it, you know, sort of bit by bit from on the ground, they helped the Taliban regroup, and they then pushed them, very clearly pushed them and supported them and financed them and drove the strategic thinking of the Taliban to create an insurgency against the foreign intervention. They did a particularly big offensive against NATO troops when NATO expanded into the south of Afghanistan in 2006. And they drove a bombing campaign of suicide bombings against foreign troops and even against journalists like me and against a lot of community leaders throughout the years from 2006 on. And so there's been a devastating toll. Embassies have been attacked, as well as government or institutions. So it's been targeted and deliberate, and with the aim to regain influence, and I think to make the foreigners, the NATO forces and the Americans, to leave Afghanistan, so they can leave it to Pakistan, so it can return to its old influence that it had during the Taliban era.
But do you think that the Pakistanis recognize the potential danger that they have created there by destabilizing this country, by protracting this long struggle, and guaranteeing that the country will be unstable when NATO and American forces leave at the end of the year? Isn't there a potential for the Afghan Taliban, if they come back, which many predict, forming an alliance with the Pakistani Taliban, and then the state of Pakistan then would be subject to reverse sanctuary, which would be a nightmare scenario? Are they in any way aware of that potential?
They are. And of course, you know, when one says Pakistan, they're not a monolith. So
sure.
I make a strong distinction between the military, who I know are supporting the Taliban, and their intelligence service, the ISI, which is part of the military, is the same thing and the same thinking. And, of course, the civilian government, who are, I think, aware of some of these problems because they are often targeted themselves, and we've seen politicians getting killed in this. They are not in control of things. They certainly don't control foreign policy or security policy. So the entire war is being managed outside the civilian writ. And then, of course, the ordinary people, you know, don't know the half of what's going on, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. So I think, but I think Pakistan is aware of the backlash, even people in the military, because they suffer it, and some of the military have been hit in strikes against their headquarters, against some of their bases, and they're actually fighting some of these, you know, renegade groups, but I would hesitate to say it's you know, the Pakistan Taliban is against them and the Afghan Taliban are not, because it's actually all mixed up, and they're all part of the same thing. And Al-Qaeda is in there as well. And what I really criticize is that the Pakistani military has nurtured them with the intention to control these militants. And now that they can't control some of them, they tend to just hide, put their heads in the sand and deny it. And I think they continue because this is what they've always done, and it's what they know. And that's extremely dangerous because the program is completely out of control now.
But that's a subject in itself, is it not, Carnatagal, the extent to which the old joke is that this is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And if you have this is the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet. They're moving into tactical nuclear weapons, building more than any other country. And it appears that they, in effect, they've also been guilty of nuclear proliferation through AQ Khan, which was hardly an accident. So you can make the case that this is a country whose state policy is terrorism under a nuclear umbrella. And how many times have we heard our leaders say the worst possible future threat we face is the world's most dangerous weapons ending in the hands of the world's most dangerous people?
Yes, and in fact, that's what we've got. I think where the certainly the U.S. administration and many in Western nations fall short, in my mind, in their thinking, is they say, therefore, the current policy of staying, engaging Pakistan and remaining friends and maintaining the relationship of engagement is the way forward, because woe betide if more radical people got hold of the nuclear weapons. And I think they're thinking of militants. But that's ridiculous, because that's saying, to take an extreme case, that's saying we won't fight Hitler because the Hitler Youth might get hold of the levers of power. It's all part of the same thing. And what has to happen is there has to be a way, and I'm not suggesting a military way. I think there's other ways, using economic leverage and diplomacy, to change the policy of always using proxy forces to fight wars and to radicalize young men and to conduct acts of terror in other countries. It's just it's exporting terrorism, and it's just not shouldn't be allowed.
Again, I'm speaking with Carnatagal, who has worked for The New York Times since 1999, including more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Pakistan. She previously worked in the Balkans and in Russia, where she reported for the Financial Times and the Moscow Times. Since 2001, she has spent longer than any other Western reporter in Afghanistan, living among the Afghans and traveling extensively through the region. And clearly, Carnatagal, you don't get do-overs in foreign policy, but it does seem extraordinary how just at the moment, I see this enormous double standard. You know, the U.S., the Congress, and the House, and now the White House has been forced into denying the visa of a Iranian diplomat who's close to Iran's new so-called moderate leader. He's been labeled a terrorist by Ted Cruz and others because he translated for the students who took over the American embassy back in 1979. So here we are denying this guy. At the same time, we're in denial about the extent to which the entire Pakistan government and its military in particular and its intelligence service have been creating terrorism and exporting it. And it's been directed at the United States. So I find that extraordinary. But in terms of a do-over, it always struck me as extraordinary that the Iranians were so cooperative after 9/11, and the Indians have built a road from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat, which would be a perfect way to supply Afghanistan, and instead of going through Pakistan, where they gouge us mercilessly. What's your sense about that? I mean, in other words, as far as I recall, the reward that Iran got for helping us out after 9/11 in Afghanistan was to be put on the list of the axis of evil.
Yes, and it's what is interesting is that Iran, although they've always interfered in Afghanistan, and they still do support some insurgent groups, they do try and, you know, buy influence right up to parliament and the palace, and they do interfere in the local administrations of some of the neighboring areas with their borders. They have never rocked the boat so much as Pakistan has. They've certainly in these last, this last decade of American and NATO intervention. For example, they've never allowed the shaped charges that were so devastating, in roadside bombs, attacking American troops in Iraq. Those came from Iran, but they didn't use them in Afghanistan. So they've controlled their position, and it's been, furthering their interests, but never to too aggressively and never to the detriment or really disastrously for Afghanistan. And so they come out of this decade looking like the better neighbor than Pakistan, which is extraordinary considering, you know, they have a paranoid relationship with America and are very adversarial. It's strange, but, you know, they haven't been the worst enemy for Afghanistan these last 12 years.
And the other do-over, of course, would be going back to 2009, the elections that were rather brazenly rigged. In your new book, Carletta Gohl, The Wrong Enemy, America and Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014, you talk about being in the palace, I guess, and you watched Karzai's face the day in the palace with John Kerry, who then, I guess, was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's now Secretary of State, being told that he'd failed to win the first round of the elections. And you say that I knew Karzai would not forgive the United States for the humiliation. What happened there? Did the Bushes just sort of pass this off to Obama? Was there a chance? Because I've spoken to Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who tried to blow the whistle on this whole rigged election. And frankly, if Abdullah, who's running in now, would have won back then, you couldn't have done worse than Karzai, right? But somehow or other, we decided to eat it?
Yeah, I think Karzai refused to accept. And so suddenly, I think, to accept the result, and they were at a bit of an impasse. So that's what Kerry, I think, negotiated with Karzai. Okay, look, you accept to go to a second round. And then, actually, in the second round, I think Karzai would have won because he has the Pashtun vote because he's a native Pashtun, and they are the biggest ethnic bloc. So actually, in a second round, I think Abdullah probably would not have beaten Karzai. That's the irony, that this whole struggle was over something which actually an election Karzai probably would have won, and he probably didn't need to rig the vote. But the real point that I make there was that the America by meddling and Karzai understood that they were trying to replace him, that the U.S. administration was tired of him and wanted someone else as president. That made him never forgive them. And then from then on, the relationship, as you've seen, has got worse and worse to the point where there's very, very little communication between President Obama and President Karzai, and very difficult negotiations over, you know, the status of forces agreement, which he's now refusing to sign. And I trace all that back to that time when the war was going bad and the relationship then also went bad. And I just think that was unavoidable, you know. But sorry, that was avoidable. You know?
Sure. Didn't Obama somewhat dig a hole for himself by campaigning on the idea that the Bush people took their eye off the ball and with going into Iraq while leaving Afghanistan unfinished, and that he was going to do a better job? I mean, What kind of advice was he getting? Because my understanding is that Afghanistan is a rentier state. It's not self-sustainable. And whoever takes it on is taking on, you know, an enormous burden.
Right. But I think he was right. Because, I mean, I make the same point that you know, that actually it was the important war to get right. Al-Qaeda is really why I stayed all the time reporting in Afghanistan. To me, it was the original story. It was where 9/11 began. And where it was still going on, because bin Laden was still at large, and his deputy, al-Zawahiri, is still at large today and still orchestrating, you know, al-Qaeda franchises around the world. And I'm now in North Africa, and I see his reach is arriving there. So I think Obama had the right idea. Yes, was it wise to say he would resolve it? Of course, he was lucky and did get bin Laden. And that is his way of saying, really, we succeeded. But Afghanistan, I feel, despite his campaigning, he then very quickly let drop. And I think that was a mistake of leadership on Obama's part, because he didn't devote the leadership and the effort to putting it right. And I think he could have put it right. I think the surge actually worked, but that Obama cut its wings because he didn't want it to go on for too long. He already stated the withdrawal date, which meant that Pakistan and Afghanistan could calculate to hang on a bit longer until the foreign forces left. So Obama, I think, just didn't try very hard once he was in power, which was strange when you think of what he was always saying as a campaigner when he was campaigning for election. You know, I can go on talking about how difficult it is to work in Afghanistan or to win a war in Afghanistan, but I do think actually the Taliban could have been curtailed and beaten with better policies, and part of that was understanding and tackling the threat at source in Pakistan.
But Khaled Agol, they were beaten. I mean, isn't that the tragedy here, that after their defeat in 2003, the Taliban, you arguing in your book, the Taliban could have been persuaded to rejoin Afghan society, and that was clearly under the Bush administration, was where the ball was really dropped.
Yes, I think, I mean, going off to Iraq obviously was a drastic decision that took away all the attention and the good minds and the intelligence collectors. But also it made Pakistan think that America was eventually going to move out and pull out and could not fight two wars. And so it was time for them to regroup and restart the Taliban and therefore get its own force back in position to take over power. So it was fatal in many ways, and as well as just leaving bin Laden, you know, free and at large and to continue his work. So that was catastrophic, I agree. And I think the Taliban could have been wooed over. I think a lot of them went back into fighting because Pakistan ordered them to or threatened them if they did not. So I came across cases of that where they were, you know, living in Pakistan with their families as refugees, and Pakistan therefore had a hold on them and said, you go and fight or else. So all of that could have been avoided with wiser minds, as well as the counterterrorism campaign, which I think was set at many Afghans, especially in the Pashtun areas, against the foreigners, against the Western forces. So there's many mistakes there, but I think then, again, there were more mistakes from the Obama administration.
But the broadest mistake, I guess, is the one that you point out, which is that in many ways we sort of fell right into bin Laden's playbook. We dignified his most paranoid fantasies about the evil West by, you know, going into two Muslim countries, and waging war there. I mean, that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. And do you think that if indeed our footprint was a part of the problem, by removing our footprint, what's happening? I mean, it seems like most of the predictions are that this state's going to fall apart pretty quickly and probably end up where it was back before 9/11, when the first thing that al-Qaeda did before blowing up the Twin Towers and the Pentagon was to kill the Northern Alliance leader, Massoud, who I believe your father was quite close to, was he not?
Yeah, well, he certainly met him a number of times and made a documentary film on him, and he'd certainly interviewed him numerous times. Mm. So, yes, you're completely right on all that. I think bin Laden did want to drag the West into a sort of monumental clash with the Western world, between Western world and Muslim countries, and he really wanted to fight it on Afghan soil, which was where he cut his teeth as a young fighter, a place he loved, where he'd obviously got all his bases and training and lots of foreign forces, as well as a huge pool of young, you know, ill-educated men in Afghanistan and Pakistan who could be encouraged to rise up. And that was his dream, I think, to have this great battle with the West and with the other superpower. He felt he had a part in bringing down the Soviet Union and making them withdraw from Afghanistan the first time around. And so he wanted to take on the last superpower, America. So I think that we did walk into that trap. And I think now at the American military and CIA have revised, you know, there are cleverer ways to fight this wave of Islamism, which is spreading, and we've seen since 9/11 it's spread. The only thing I would pull you up on, perhaps, is I don't believe that it would have just stopped there if the West had not intervened in Afghanistan. I think what was going on in the camps, the training, the massive outreach to reach other, you know, Muslim men from all countries, especially Central Asian countries, especially any country where there's repression or dictatorship, they really work on the youth, the young, angry young men, the repressed, to alert them of their, to ignite their anger, if you were, in this this movement of Islamism. And I think that was going to go on apace regardless of what the West did. I think what we have to do is think of how to save societies from them and how to, prevent it increasing. And I'm seeing this in Tunisia, where there is a sudden rush after the revolution for young people to go towards Salafism and extremism, and how the government there is having to grapple with that. And I think every Muslim country is going to be grappling with that. And the West has to think of cleverer ways to fight it, or to help better way to help these countries be aware of it and draw people in other directions, because you can't have a war in every country, and it's self-defeating, as we've seen.
But hasn't, I mean, not only has Pakistan been duplicitous in dealing with the United States and fanning and nurturing extremism of the kind that you're talking about, the Saudis forever, our good friends the Saudis, have been funding this fundamentalism in terms of Islam itself and the Salafism or the Wahhabi sect, which they've spread around the world and spent an enormous amount of money on. Isn't that, in the broader sense, a big part of the problem in creating the environment, the kind of ideological environment that allows people to take it a little further, as Al-Qaeda does?
Yes, absolutely, and I do. I don't really touch on it because I'm not an expert on Saudi Arabia in my book, but it undoubtedly has come from there, this immense oil wealth, this desire to spread Wahhabism, which is their very austere form of Islam. And I think, of course, if you follow the money trail, it's really responsible for a lot of this. You know, so many of the mosques and madrasas built in Pakistan, which are indoctrinating all these young men, are Saudi-funded. But where I look at, where I think Pakistan is particularly dangerous, is then Pakistan takes it one step further and does the actual training. You know, all these young boys are not only learning in the mosques a very radical type of Islam, but they're also going to camps and they're learning to use weapons, they're learning to be suicide bombers, they're going off to practice fighting in Afghanistan and Kashmir and so on. And so Pakistan is putting into practice the most lethal part of this is spread of Islamism. And that's really reprehensible. And that's where I think Admiral Mullen, who was then the about-to-retire U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, said in his congressional testimony that what Pakistan is doing is not only damaging itself and its standing, but it's breaking international norms, and it probably warrants sanction. And he's really the first one who's actually said, you know, categorically what Pakistan is doing is against international law. And, you know, someone's got to call them to account, and it's got to stop.
Well, Carletta Gore, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, and we haven't even got to talk about some of the more explosive stuff that you've got in your book about how the extent to which the ISI knew about bin Laden being there in Abbottabad, where he was eventually killed by the SEAL team.
Yeah.
So perhaps during our next fund drive, if we can track you down again, we'd love to talk to you further.
I'd be delighted. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Carletta Gore, who has worked for The New York Times since 1999, including more than 10 years in Afghanistan and Pakistan. She previously worked in the Balkans and in Russia, where she reported for the Financial Times and the Moscow Times. And since 2001, she spent longer than any other Western reporter in Afghanistan, living among the Afghans and traveling extensively through the region. She was the lead reporter on the New York Times team that won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2009, and is now the Times' North Africa correspondent. correspondent. Her latest book just out is The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into how your tax dollars are spent.